We'll call the House Committee on Health and Human Services to order this Monday, March 14th, 2005. We have two items on the agenda this morning, colleagues. A public hearing on House Bill 2080, which is going to help us try to get additional capacity through volunteer physicians to be able to get into primary care clinics and expand opportunities for folks who need health care. And then following that, we'll have an informational hearing on the Oregon State Hospital and an overview of the Mental Health and Addiction Services Office. And we're going to be doing at least two meetings today and Wednesday on the State Hospital, and likely a third meeting. We're really going to try to get as much information as we can on the hospital in anticipation of the report that the master plan that's being constructed right now by a consultant to look at what would work best for the future of the state hospital. So I think this is a pretty good time to do that. And colleagues, note that our Wednesday meeting starts at 4 o'clock, and we've done that to allow folks who are working during the day to be able to join us after 5 o'clock. So with that, I would like to open the public hearing on House Bill 2080. I'd like to welcome Representative Susan Morgan up, and also former Representative Bill Markham, if you'd like to come up.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rodolfo. For the record, I'm Susan Morgan. I represent House District 2, which is the southern part of Douglas County and pieces of Josephine and Jackson County. I thank you very much for allowing a public hearing on House Bill 2080, which I sponsored at the request of former Representative Bill Markham. I think this bill has a great deal of merit, and I welcome the opportunity for you to gain some knowledge about the need for the bill and how the bill is structured, and some amendments that will be introduced for your action. This morning, I'm going to pass and just recognize former Representative Bill Markham, who has a very distinguished career. In fact, was a member of this body for 28 years until term limits got him, and I replaced him. Also coming to testify before you today is Barney Spate and Bruce Bishop, and I will just turn the proceedings over to those folks, Chair Dalto, and thank you again for this opportunity.
Oh, thanks very much. Representative Markham, did you have a few words to say? Or
I have some testimony, if I may.
Oh, sure.
And I ask Mr. Bishop and Mr. Spate to join me, if I may.
That'd be great.
Probably a good thing I got run out of the legislature, because Susan probably would have done that for me here 8 years ago. She's a wonderful gal and works hard. She does a great job, in my opinion, around here. Chairman Dalto and members, I appreciate very much the opportunity to be here. For the record, my name is Bill Markham and reside now in Roseburg, Oregon, formerly in Riddle, which is 20 miles south of there for 50 years. And I served in the Oregon House of Representatives from 1969 till 1999, almost 30 years. Thank you for holding the hearing on 2080 relating to the volunteer physicians and health care providers, and there are 19 total of health care providers, and the community clinics. I must admit that my interest in health policy during my legislative career was quite limited. But driving down here a couple of days ago, I tried to crank up my brain as what I'd done in health care through those years. Excuse me? Oh, I'm sorry. I don't hear well, and during my legislative career, and rather limited, but I thought of a few things, and I'll just mention those, if I may, Mr. Chairman, members. In 1971, I introduced legislation that established the scope of practice of physician's assistant, and that came about because the doctor who hatched my third son, or our third son, from Canyonville, in a very small little operation hospital he had there, he asked me to see if he could get a scope of practice together, because, and I didn't even know what that meant when he talked to me, because he just recently hired a retired military guy who had worked in as a physician's assistant for years in the military, and he hired him, and he didn't know how far he could get from him and stay within the scope of practice, and so that's where that came from. Second thing, I worked after that, and I don't remember what year, with the Oregon Nurses Association lobbyist, a gal I'd gotten well acquainted with, and we were able to, and I put the bill in, I think, I don't know now, but to gain independent practice for nurse practitioners. And I talked to my son, who happens to be a medic, and he said, why not let them, as long as they're responsible for what they do? So I went ahead with the bill from my viewpoint and helped the nurses get that one going. And then later, there was always a fight every session with the OMA over whether the optometrists and the ophthalmologists over who could use topical drugs. And, of course, it went on for session after session. And then when Jason Bowe became president of the Senate, I was able to get the bill through the House. We co-sponsored it, and, of course, it was a slam dunk over there because you blink twice and you're out of there when Bowe was running the gavel over on that side, believe me. I probably shouldn't mention this, but I remember Frank Roberts tried to challenge him for the presidency, and Bo won again, and Frank, as I remember, didn't have an assignment. Didn't have one assignment. He ran it with an iron fist. But anyway, he was a good friend of mine, thank goodness.
Is he on the pitch committee, Representative Mark?
Another bill, if I may, I put in with a clear back in 71 with then the President of the Senate, John Burns, and I sponsored a bill to establish a tax credit for physicians who had practiced in really rural areas, and it was meaningful. It was a $10,000 tax credit, and of course that was worth a lot of money more then. And then I went home that summer, and John Kitzhoffer had gotten politically interested in running for the legislature, so I did a little checkup on him, and which you're not supposed to do, but I found out that he was taking that tax credit, can you believe, in Roseburg as a hurting area for a medical practitioner? But that's the way the bill went. I called up Burns, and he says, yeah, I know, I've already heard about it, because we let the OMA decide which was the underserved areas. So they took care of themselves. It's still a law, though, but I think they've tightened it up. Lastly, if I may, my son is a neurosurgeon in Vancouver, Washington, so I guess I helped reduce the physician shortages in the local area. And about 6 weeks ago, when these two gentlemen helped me put the bill together, we went down in the to the Legislative Council and got hold of Holly, and we were in their law library. And the first thing, this is kind of a personal thing, the first thing she did was pull up her sleeve like this. She had a scar from here to here, and she said, "Your son patched me up umpteen years ago." And said, "I got a bad accident, had all the nerves tore up, and." He patched me up and sewed it up, and she said, "I had no problem since then." And the same day, I'm up in the House lounge, and Representative Kipps comes up to me and said, "Is your son a neurosurgeon in Vancouver?" "Yep." Yeah. He said, "Well, you know, I broke my neck wrestling at Portland State University." And he said, "I went through a series of doctors in the Portland area, every kind. They couldn't figure out what was wrong. And finally somebody says, go across the river there to Markham and find out what he's got to say." So he said, "I went over there and he took some pictures of me, showed me what was wrong, had an operation. It's been great ever since." Two people scratching my back the same day. So it makes you feel good. So much for that. Why this bill? In 1991, another doctor in Roseburg came to me and said, "I want to retire in a year or two, and I'd love to do a little pro bono work at a low-income clinic or in schools, whatever. But," he said, "I'll be damned if I'm going to spend $5,000 for liability insurance to go work free." And I said, "Well, you know, Doc, it makes a little sense to me." And he said, "Well, go see if you can do something for me." I didn't know him very well, so I didn't promise him anything, but I got a bill out, which is now in the statute 30.302, that I took home and showed it, gave him a copy, and it said that the doctor who retired and wanted to work pro bono must come under the auspices and direction of the county health officer. Well, if you've been running your own medical practice for years, I don't think he didn't like the idea of having to have somebody tell him how to run his business. And I took the bill to the county court and said, "Hey, we can help some people here with this bill." And they thought it was a great idea until I talked to their insurance agent. And he said, "Our insurance rates will go out of sight because we're bringing in a doctor." So that ended that. And I don't think anybody in this state has used the bill since, which is kind of discouraging. So what happened? A year ago, I'm in Tacoma visiting my older son, oldest son. Front page of the Tacoma Times, which is their daily paper, is this picture and this article. And so I got to reading it, because what they do up there, and I'll just read you two lines here. State pays malpractice insurance, doctors volunteering their services. And then finally it shows a picture here, Doc Roger Sims steps out of the examining room to get medication for a patient at a neighborhood clinic earlier this month. Sims is a retired physician and must carry malpractice insurance with thousands of dollars in premiums, even if he works as a volunteer free. So what happened up there, and I don't want to get into all the article. The state started a program 10 years ago with about $30,000 and tried to encourage people to get involved. They're retired. And what they did, they legislature appropriated money at that time, started with $30,000 or $40,000, to the Department of Health. Department of Health contracted with a firm in Seattle of only six people, and they went out and advertised the program. And they also handled the insurance, the liability insurance, and also bought the physicians or the healthcare people. I'm going to get lost. I get wound up in this too fast. Purchase their, what am I trying to say? Their license fee, their annual license fee. The state does two things, buys their insurance and buys their license fee. Well, I got to thinking, why in the heck does the state spend money out of the general fund to go over here and pay it to a private insurance company to protect somebody who wants to work free, when my bill, if I may say so, if we can get somewhere with it, simply says, we'll bring the people in Oregon under the same protection that all the people up on Medical Hill have, which the state protects them. Am I making sense? I think I am. And we won't have to ask the legislature for money, ways and means, because they don't have any anyway. I know that. And so that's the crutch of it. I think we got a thing here that'll work if we can get this legislation passed with a couple of minor amendments. Now, let me go into my pitch, and then I'll shut up. If I may, Mr. Chairman. We know there are retired and volunteer health care providers who wish to provide health care services to low-income and no-income patients without compensation. Notwithstanding the current immunity granted to health care providers by ORS 3792, it is not clear that health clinics that could utilize such volunteer health providers are similarly immunized from legal action for the services provided by such volunteers. This bill will encourage local communities to use volunteer health care providers in existing and planned community clinics. It will encourage philanthropy, community service, and augment state resources in providing for the health care needs of those who have no access to basic health care services. An estimated 17% of Oregonians, some 600,000 people, which is a whole lot, do not have health insurance and lack ready access to basic ambulatory primary care services. This is especially problematic for low-income persons who are young and who are either unemployed or have entry-level jobs without health care benefits. Some 22% of the adults in this state between the ages of 18 and 64 are uninsured. Over 12% of the children under the age of 18 are uninsured. In rural and frontier counties, the uninsured percentages can even be higher than that. Let me paraphrase a comment by Dr. Bruce Goldberg, and most of you know him, I'm sure, the administrator of the Office of Health Policy and Research, and he said, and I quote, "Uninsured people, on the average, get medical care later in the course of illness and die sooner than insured people. Secondly, people who are uninsured are nearly three times as likely as the insured to be hospitalized for diabetics, more than twice as likely to be hospitalized for high blood pressure, and finally nearly twice as likely to be hospitalized for pneumonia or ulcers." And those are pretty profound statements from that guy. Without early prevention and primary care, the uninsured must use hospital emergency rooms for basic access or are admitted as inpatients for acute complications that could have been managed with early access to primary care. Consequently, hospitals must raise their rates to paying patients to compensate for such increases in charity care. In my own community of Roseburg, Mercy Hospital Center has seen emergency departments use rise from 23,000 plus visits in 1999 to over 40,000 visits in 03 and almost 50,000 visits in 04, and it's still going up. Charity care at that hospital was $9 million in 03, and it doubled 18 million in 04, and it's going to be that higher this year. And I don't have to, that's just one hospital in this state. Let me conclude by addressing the concerns some have expressed about immunity from lawsuits for volunteer health care providers and the clinics that utilize their services. Four states, Florida, Kansas, Virginia, and Wisconsin, have had limits on exposure to lawsuits, some dating back as far as 1992. A study conducted by the University of Washington, incidentally my school and basketball team, by the University of Washington, revealed no medical liability claims history in any of those jurisdictions have been running the type of thing that I'm proposing here. Or we're proposing. In addition, the bill retains the current statutory language providing that immunity does not apply in cases of gross negligence or recklessness, wanton or intentional misconduct. In addition to the extension of immunity to community health clinics, the other important provision of House Bill 2080 is contained in Section 1, informing retired physicians and health care providers of the protection they receive if they volunteer or when they volunteer. This function will be carried out within existing resources by the Department of Human Resources and the professional licensing boards, working closely with health professional associations to get the word out on a regular basis. The primary vehicle of this information dissemination will be professional publications by hard copy, electronic, or web-based. In addition, organizations like the Oregon Association of Hospitals and the Oregon Primary Care Association will routinely inform their institutional members of the opportunity to engage retired or volunteer health care providers in the local communities, or else start them up. Chair Dalto and members of the committee, I urge you to support this bill. There are some pending amendments to House Bill 2080 that clarify certain aspects of the bill. Others here this morning can explain the purpose of the amendments better than I. They do not, however, change the substance of the bill at all. Another idea that Senator Bates and Westland are investigating, as well as myself, is waiving the license fee for retired medical practitioners who want to practice as volunteers. And that would be the state's contribution. The state wouldn't have to come up with money. They just, wherever it is, Department of Health, they have more people to look after with no license fee income to them. But I think I think the state can afford that type of thing, or I wouldn't even think about it. You might want to talk to them about this additional incentive. And finally, let me say, Mr. Chairman, members, who benefits from this bill? Well, one, the low-income and no-income Oregonians who can receive more primary care from community health clinics, and remember, there's 600,000 of them there out there uncovered. Two, retired and volunteer physicians and health care providers who want to help in their communities. Third, hospitals, by reducing the emergency room visits and a lot of uncompensated care. And four, me, I'll feel good about the opportunity that communities will have to expand access to primary care, and I would think you people will too, if I may be that blunt. And I want to thank you, Chairman Dalto and the committee, and Senator Representative Susan Morgan for your support of this bill. In addition, I want to thank Senator Bates, Westland, and Morrison, who worked hard on it in the Senate version, as well as Barney Spate, Bruce Bishop, and Ed Patterson. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to come and present this, folks.
Thank you very much, Representative Markham. I think we'll continue along with the presentation, and then we'll stop for questions or comments. So, who would like to proceed?
There are members.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Barney Spate, and I work for the Department of Human Services Office of Medical Assistance Program, but I'm appearing here today as a volunteer pro bono advisor to former Representative Markham, along with my colleague Bruce Bishop. With the permission of the chair, I thought I would run through the Dash 1 amendments and just highlight what they're intended to do. The first amendment on page 1, line 5, is to basically indicate that the Department of Human Services, in consultation with appropriate professional and trade associations and licensing boards, will inform retired physicians and health care providers regarding the provisions of this act. It does delete the section that refers to recruitment, so this is primarily an information and outreach that will be done, as Representative Markin indicated, through working with professional associations. Secondly, there's a clarifying amendment on line 18 in the definition of health clinic, adding uninsured prior to uninsured low-income patients. And lastly, we are suggesting the narrowing of the immunity that's granted on line 26 to a health clinic, that the health clinic would be immune from actions relative to the assistance services or advice provided by the volunteer provider. And this would provide that the clinic would have the same type of immunity for volunteers practicing in the community clinic. I believe that these various amendments under Dash 1, Mr. Chair, represent the consensus of the feedback we've gotten both on the House side and the Senate side about the concerns about the bill. So that's the impact of the Dash 1 amendments,
including trial lawyers,
and including the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, that I believe sought and is supportive, I'm told, of the narrowing of the liability on line 26.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, here to recommend your endorsement of House Bill 2080 with the Dash 1 amendments. It's a good bill. I urge you to adopt the amendments and to move the bill through the process. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. There's questions or comments? Representative O'Mahon.
Thank you. Maybe, Barney, this is for you. Could you just explain to me how the Dash 1 amendments on line 26 and refers back to
Sub A.
A, right, charitable,
yeah.
Corporation, da, da, da. So in ORS 128.620, that absolves charitable corporations from liability?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, the current law, which we are amending, 3792, provides immunity from actions, damages, for a health care provider who volunteers to provide care in a charitable corporation. What we are doing through this bill is to extend that immunity to the health clinic itself for the actions of the volunteer and only the volunteer. So there could be a clinic, and oftentimes there are, where there's a combination of employed or salaried clinicians and some volunteers. This would immunize the clinic only for actions of the volunteers. The clinic would remain potentially liable for other actions of employees or as a business itself.
Okay.
It's primarily to, I guess, close the loop to make certain that both community-based clinics and those who want to volunteer in them are immunized from damages, other than, as Representative Markin pointed out, reckless or wanton behavior.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Bruin.
I just wondered if it covers the psychologists. They're not a physician. Psychologist.
I can handle
someone. A volunteer counselor.
Chair Dalto and Representative Moon, I've attached, or there's attached to your testimony on the third page, Representative Markham's testimony, a list of the 19 healthcare providers that would be
I didn't see that. Thank
swept
you.
Yeah. Into this, and this is just through a cross-reference in current Oregon statute, and it's pretty inclusive, and I believe both licensed clinical social workers, psychologists, and a number of others are listed there.
I didn't see that. Sorry. Thank you.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, my original bill back in 15 years ago only went to the physician because that's the only one that asked me to put it in. But this covers the waterfront of health care people, which it should.
Okay. Additional comments?
Mr. Chair, could you indulge me just a
yes,
minute?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you. Mr. Markham, there was a wonderful, when you mentioned Canyonville, it reminded me of a wonderful restaurant that I used to go to called Mexi's along the highway.
They finally retired and passed away up on the hill just out of Canyonville.
Right.
It was a wonderful place. Even the health department in Douglas County didn't like them.
I love them. I mean, hamburgers,
what do you think
big
of that?
Pie.
I can comment on it. I mean, she baked the pies and he cooked the hamburgers.
Oh, yeah.
If you had a needed a restroom, it was a three-holer up on the hill, and they washed the dishes by having hot water, warm water, and cold water, and run them through. Nobody ever got sick in 50 years up there. And one time, and then I'll be quiet about this, I was up there with, and of course all the local guys go up there at noon, it's 2 miles out of Canyonville. And some young health inspector from Douglas County, who I think was fresh out of Berkeley, decided he'd go up and inspect it, and he just wrote him up a list like this. And a couple of guys that are larger than I literally picked this guy up, took him outside and sat him down and said, "Don't you ever come back in here again or you'll need a new head." Now, I listened to it all. And I called the county commissioner. I said, "You better educate this guy. You're going to have a murder down here." So that guy never did come back, and nobody ever got sick, but it was an institution.
Oh, yes, it was wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. And colleagues, we've received some email testimony from the Healthcare Safety Net Coalition and Joy Source in strong support of House Bill 2080, so Sandy will be distributing that in a moment. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2080. And colleagues, just as a side note, you have a copy of an audit report on cost savings, drug cost savings that Representative Greenlake wanted to make sure that we all had a copy of, so look for that in your pile there so you can add to your files, and we appreciate that, Representative Greenlake. And so we will move now to the informational hearing on the Oregon State Hospital, and we'll invite Barry Cass and Bob Nickel forward with Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. Good morning.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Chair Dalto, members of the committee, I'm Barry Cass, Assistant Director for Health Services of the Department of Human Services. Pleasure to be here today. Usually here defending a budget or rationalizing a program, my job this morning is limited to talking a little bit about the history of the state hospital, which is fascinating, and I hope that we'll put in context some of the things you'll be hearing and seeing over the course of these hearings and as the session progresses to making important decisions about the future of that hospital. This is the battle of the beds, as Joe Trelevin, a former superintendent, used to call it, about finding places for people who needed care. And one of the things you'll hear in the next few minutes is that the themes that are coming up in the this century really go back to the 1800s. There are themes like whether the state's obligation is to provide an asylum or to provide treatment and a cure, whether our primary function is security or therapy, and who's responsible? Is it the state or the county? And what is the relationship between the state and the county in caring for people with serious mental illness? Cost. The growth of the patient population, which virtually began on the first day of providing care. Crowding. And then, of course, waves of reform, which have been going on since the early 1900s. I want to give some credit to Olaf Larcel, a physician at the University of Oregon Medical School at the time, who published The Doctor in Oregon, and anyone who's interested in the history of medicine in the state, this is a fabulous book, published in 1840, and we have a copy signed by Dr. Larcel as a kind of a little treasure of mine. He also has a whole chapter on psychiatric care in this volume that was actually first published in the Oregon Historical Quarterly in 1945. Dr. Larcel's painting hangs in the library at the medical school, along with Dr. Hawthorne, who ran the first asylum here in the state of Oregon, Dr. Philippi, who subsequently ran that hospital and became one of the founders of the medical school. So the history of mental health in Oregon is really intricately tied with the history of medicine in the state, and it's a fascinating history, and although I can't relate it all to you this morning, I think it's really worth your time, and I'll make the article from the Historical Quarterly available through the administrator. These themes date back literally to the first references to mental illness, which at that time was referred to as insanity, in the records of the fur trade, in the wanderings of John Day in 1811, who had a serious mental illness, and became codified in the statutes adopted at Shampui at the time the territory was being organized. In those statutes, duties were assigned to the counties to treat the insane, to care for them when other resources were not available. Now, I live near Corvallis, not far from Oakville Road, which is formerly the Poor Farm Road, which is where many people with all kinds of disabilities resided when they had no resources. The county in those days was the payer of last resort. In the 1850 census, there were 5 insane people in the state, according to the census. And the population growth that occurred in the 1850s as the territory expanded rapidly saw that number grow. In 1855, a law was passed making the territory responsible for the care of the insane and rapidly repealed. The territory had very little in the way of funds. This seesaw between the state and the territory, and subsequently the state and the counties, has been going on for a long time, and we're fortunate that Bob Nickel is able to mediate that today and work with the states to reach agreement about how we will provide the right services in this century. In 1861, Dr. James Hawthorne and a physician named Luria emerged. They built a hospital in 1862 to care for these people. The Oregon Insane Hospital operated for nearly 20 years before Oregon State Hospital was constructed. In fact, Dr. Hawthorne is buried at Lone Fir Cemetery near Belmont in Portland, and many of the patients were buried there. And as you will undoubtedly see in today's New York Times, there's continuing discussion about the disposition of patients who die in public care, and there's even a controversy about the Lone Fir Cemetery because some of those graves have not been accounted for. Go back to the 1860s to about 1883. I said there were 5 insane people in 1850. By 1860, there were 23 in the census. Governor Gibbs, seeing the cost of paying for Dr. Hawthorne's hospital growing, proposed in 1862 that a state hospital be built in Salem, and he recommended in the meantime that care continue to be purchased from Dr. Hawthorne. The cost was then $12 per week. 1863, there were 28 mentally ill people, and a wing was added to Dr. Hawthorne's hospital. In 1864, there were 43. The rate, of course, since there were more patients, dropped to $10 per week, subsequently to $8 per week as the census increased to 81 patients by 1866. So in 4 years, there was a growth of roughly a twofold increase in the number of patients under Dr. Hawthorne's care. By that time, there were 11 wards at Dr. Hawthorne's hospital, and in 1870, there were 111 patients. And I want you to think about the history of this process in terms of this continuing pressure for the care of additional Oregonians. Hawthorne was attacked in the press for the high cost of providing care to these patients and for holding them too long in his custody for the sole reason of increasing his take. But several reviews of the hospital, including one done by Dorothea Dix, a reformer from the East, cleared Dr. Hawthorne of those charges. The growth in numbers was attributable to population growth and to extraordinary immigration. Dr. Larcel notes in his work that patients of all nationalities were represented in the hospital, and cultural diversity is still an issue in the provision of care in the state. From 12 patients in 1862 to 167 patients in 1872 to 235 patients in 1878, with its attendant growth in cost, there is a notation in one of the paragraphs that in 1868, paying Dr. Hawthorne consumed about half of all the revenue that the state of Oregon was collecting at that time. And Bob Nickel has mentioned in other hearings that he would settle for a figure close to that for mental health today. Dr. Hawthorne himself recommended building the state hospital in the 1870s. He noted the problem with the state's debt limit because it would have taken more money than the state was empowered to raise to build the hospital, and he proposed a small tax. By 1877, the more than 230 patients in Dr. Hawthorne's care were costing the state about $70,000 a year. Hawthorne was again attacked for this large expense, and the legislature finally authorized the construction of a state hospital, expected to provide care at about $4 a day. Cost was related to quality, quality being defined in those days as humane treatment, with claims that at the time that the cost was proposed was too low, not too high. So there was a debate about just how much treatment we ought to give people. Are we providing an asylum? Or are we providing an aggressive program that should lead to cure? And in those days, the records were kept about how many patients actually got better and were able to leave the hospital. This, the Oregon State Asylum opened here in Salem, just down the street, in 1883 with 412 beds, initially admitting 268 patients. 5 years later, there were 526 patients. And 10 years after that, there were 1,200 patients. The role was more and more over time one of asylum and less of treatment. In 1907, the state appointed a Dr. Steiner to run the hospital. Steiner is one of the two great figures in the, including our esteemed Dr. Fickle, our current superintendent. Dr. Steiner had a tenure of about 30 years and was later replicated when Dr. Brooks was the superintendent for nearly 30 years. Both born out of eras of reform. As Dr. Steiner made the argument that we ought to be treating people and treating them aggressively because they can get well. But the hospital was growing so fast, that the burden of patients was so high that staff were being required to work, staff were being required to work 12 hours a day, and there were reforms in the labor laws in those days limiting the workday to 8 hours. The State Board of Control, the governor, the treasurer, and the secretary of state made the argument that those labor laws did not apply to governments. The matter was tested when Dr. Steiner was actually arrested on a ship in Puget Sound heading for China, brought back to the capital, and subsequently exonerated. But the point was made that the hospital needed reform. In 1908, the legislature changed the name from Oregon State Asylum to Oregon State Hospital, and at the same time took the feeble-minded, as they were called in those days, and created another institution called Fairview and moved what were in effect developmentally disabled people to a different location. The continuing growth of the patient population led to the opening of Eastern Hospital in Pendleton in 1913, and 300 patients were transferred from Oregon State Hospital to Pendleton. But by 1914, the census at Oregon State Hospital was up to 1,576. 1915 saw the passage by the legislature of the first parole law, that would allow patients to be furloughed from the hospital without discharging them from care. It was done to reduce crowding. In 1928, there was a debate about insane criminals, and a ward was proposed at Oregon State Penitentiary for individuals who were mentally ill and had committed a crime. There are echoes of that debate going on right now. We're talking about the relationship between the people who are not responsible for their crimes because of their mental illness and people who have been convicted of crimes or are in the custody of the Department of Corrections but have very serious mental illness, and how those two populations overlap, and it was happening 80 years ago. In 1931, with additional crowding at the hospital, the state imposed a tax, in effect, of $20 a month for each commitment that the counties were sending to the hospital. This had, of course, a dampening effect on the rate of civil commitment. It fell to the county to pay when the family of the patient was without resources. By 1936, there were 2,450 patients, but only 2,100 beds. From 1920 to 1940, the budgeted growth of the hospital was 28 beds per year, but the population growth, or the patient population growth, was about 50 per year. So you can see these lines diverging over time. In 1942, a tragedy struck the hospital in which a patient substituted a poison for powdered eggs, and 47 patients died in one morning. There were actually some staff who died as well. This made the front page of the New York Times. I'm told that we're on the front page of the New York Times again today with respect to the cremains that remain at the hospital. That drew attention to the hospital's need for improvement, and yet another era of reform began in the middle of the Second World War. The legislature increased the capacity of the hospital to 2,800 beds, and there were 2,622 patients in 1944, and admissions had climbed to nearly 1,000 patients per year. This period of reform that began here in Oregon with that tragedy actually extended nationwide for a number of years. It was driven by, among other things, the discovery during the Second World War that mental illness is a consequence of conflict and also impairs the ability of a military to function. And in 1946, the National Institutes of Mental Health were created. There was a good deal of publishing. There was a book called Shame of the States, which exposed the conditions in state hospitals around the country. A movie called The Snake Pit, which sort of dramatized this in a perhaps a melodramatic way. And suddenly there was interest nationally in improving the plight of the mentally ill, most of whom were cared for in large institutions like ours. In the 1950s, with the advent of new molecules, new medicines, things like Thorazine and so forth, gave new hope to patients. Patients were getting better who hadn't been thriving before. But the hospital kept growing. Among other things, antibiotics made tuberculosis treatable without sanitaria, and the state hospital actually absorbed many of the patients who were residing in sanitariums. That's why if you go back in the records of the state hospital in Fairview, you'll find a number of chest surgeons treating people with mental illness and developmental disabilities. It's a sidebar, but it's a fascinating one. When I joined the mental health system, the head of the mental and emotional branch of the division was a chest surgeon named Pomeroy. What the state was experiencing, however, was two kinds of patients. There were younger patients who were treatable and were moving out into the community and getting discharged, and there was a large body of aging patients who were remaining in the hospital, who had been effectively living there all of their adult lives. And the state began planning for a long-term care psychiatric hospital. That hospital was developed in the early to mid-50s, built in the end of the 50s, and opened in 1962, Damish State Hospital in Wilsonville, hospital which we closed in 1965. It was built as a nursing home. There was no privacy. The wards were shaped around bays with 10 patients in like a British medical comedy, really. It was a very interesting development because by the time the hospital opened, it was in effect obsolete, since those older patients were increasingly being served in nursing facilities. That has been an expanding industry in our state, and as you know, we've had some leadership in developing not only nursing facilities but alternatives to nursing facilities. Many of the people who used to go to a state hospital can be effectively cared for in intermediate care facilities. When the planning for DAMAGE began, the total state hospital census, Eastern and OSH, was 5,000 patients. And today we have, what, 750? Mm-hmm. So a lot has happened in between, and you'll be discussing that in more detail, but just to give you a sort of an overview. After the 1950s action report on mental illness, Governor Hatfield at that time promoted reforms in this state, and nationally in 1963, during the Kennedy administration, was the passage of the National Mental Health Centers Act. That goal of that act was to put a community center in every catchment of 250,000 people in this country. And while the country didn't get there, a lot of progress was made in bringing treatment into community settings so people didn't have to go to institutions to get that care. In 1973, with Supreme Court decisions enhancing or recognizing the rights of mental patients, there was a major reform of our commitment laws, and the legislature funded specific community alternatives to institutional care. We began to see the development of group homes and day treatment programs and those kinds of innovations at that time, which reduced the reliance on state hospitals. And that's where people like Bob and I can come into the picture. That was an era of expansion in the mental health system that brought, I think, new enthusiasm about the ability of the state to provide community-based care and keep families intact and avoid the isolating influence of institutional care. There was a growing number of patients who were found to be innocent of their crimes because they weren't responsible due to their mental illness. And in 1978, the legislature created the Psychiatric Security Review Board. This is the area of greatest pressure and expansion at the state hospital in this decade. So over the 1970s and 80s, we saw the census drop. Things became more concentrated around programs like services for forensic patients. By 1987, however, the United States Department of Justice was looking at major institutions. There were state hospitals and training centers around the country being sued for civil rights violations. At the same time that the Healthcare Financing Administration, now called CMS, was questioning the certification of those facilities. And Oregon established a commission which recommended major changes in the state hospital, published in 1988. That was the blueprint for development over the next 10 years. Acute care, which had been provided in the hospital, was moved to community-based care. Community residential programs were developed at a very rapid pace. Capital improvements to the state hospital were recommended, but that part of the report really wasn't substantially implemented. And those staffing improvements were recommended, and many were implemented. Oregon's staffing levels still fall behind the targets that were established. With the closure in 1995 of DAMAGE State Hospital, Oregon's options for continuing growth in its inpatient population at the state hospitals was constrained. And today, as you'll hear in the subsequent discussion, we are now facing what I think is really the definition of a crisis. When faced with necessity and having no options, we find ourselves in a quandary, and I think that's where we're headed here in the middle of this decade. From the late 90s to now, there's been alarming growth in criminal commitments. The state hospital, after many years of closing wards, is now opening them again. We find ourselves today, as more than a century ago, struggling with cost, with quality, with the role of the state and the role of the county, with continuing calls for reform, and crowding and ceaseless pressure of demand from new patient populations. And so in some sense, the more things change, the more they stay the same. I hope there is some comfort in that we have responded to this kind of situation a number of times in the history of our state, and I feel quite confident that the leadership we're seeing today and the interest taken by the legislature in the future of the hospital will bring us to yet another successful outcome. I hope that's helpful in setting the stage for your discussions with Bob Nickel and his pardon me, and his staff. Mr. Chairman?
Thanks very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Nickel, and I'm the administrator for the State Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services. And I first want to start off by thanking the chair and the committee for taking such a large chunk of your time to get information about what is admittedly a very complicated and, as Barry has described, a very challenging set of issues that we are dealing with in the state hospital. What I want to do this morning, briefly, with permission of the chair, is not to make a long presentation at all, but simply to give an overview of how we're going to provide information to the committee over the next week, and then just make some general comments. So first of all, I think the overview that Mr. Cast has provided is very, very helpful in terms of understanding the broad sweep of where we've been. I don't know if Mr. Cast mentioned it, but we peaked at about 5,000 patients in the late 1950s. Were we to continue that sort of trend, we would have an overwhelming huge budget and institution. And while we're bursting at the seams with 750 patients right now, I can't imagine what this state would be doing financially or programmatically if we had 10,000 or 12,000 or 15,000, whatever the equivalent today would have been in the late 1950s. In a few minutes, Dr. Marvin Fickle, who is both Chief Medical Officer and Superintendent of Oregon State Hospital, will describe to you in more detail the kind of treatment units, the type of patients that we have, and several of the issues that he would like to inform you of related to census, performance measures, and some very general budget information. We have with us today two very key managers within the state hospital system, George Bocek and John Keogh. They will describe for you in somewhat more detail some of the challenges, particularly in the forensic units. On Wednesday afternoon, and I do appreciate the chance to have a late afternoon, early evening session, because I know that it's allowing some people to be here who would not otherwise be able to testify. We will start off with Mr. Jonathan Ader, who was co-chair of the Governor's Mental Health Task Force. And Mr. Ader has a great deal of experience, not only as a private businessman with a major law firm, but also has been very involved with a number of state initiatives over the years. He's been very helpful, I think, in thinking through in a creative way what we're doing, not only with the community mental health system, but also the state hospital. We are going to hear a presentation from Dr. Satya Chandragiri, and hear how he has implemented, along with the staff at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center, a very clear recovery model. And I won't try to get into the detail of that, but I think you'll find that very interesting. Mr. Maynard Hammer, who is the Deputy Superintendent of Oregon State Hospital, will then describe the master plan process that we've embarked upon. He'll also give you more detail about the Oregon State Hospital physical plant and some of the projects that we're doing there. We've asked the two major unions that represent employees to participate in our presentation. I don't know what they're going to say. I have exercised absolutely no censorship, not that I could, but I really feel that it's important for the unions, SEIU and AFSCME, to have a chance to describe to the committee. I appreciate the committee's willingness to work with us on having represented employees speak to you. And finally, on Friday, I think it's very important that we have a chance to hear about the county approaches, the ways in which they're interfacing with us in the state hospital system. And Gina Furman will be here from the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Program Directors. And we will finish up our part of the presentation by having a couple of the key managers in my office describe a co-management of census proposal that we're working on now with the county mental health directors, more clearly defining, I hope, how we will interface with those patients who are in the state hospital, and we're going to start with the civil commitment population. And finally, with the committee's permission, I would like a chance to have for you describe the extended care and enhanced care system that we have. Essentially, what we have in Oregon is not just a state hospital. It's really a system. Now, is it a complete system of care? I think that's That's something that is a goal of all of ours. But the fact is that we not only have the 750 beds in the state hospital, but we buy about, at any given time, 200 acute care hospital beds in the community, plus about 800 by the end of this biennium, enhanced community placements that, for the most part, counties and private nonprofit providers operate for us, which takes an incredible amount of the pressure off the state hospital. If we hadn't created these, as Barry has mentioned, over the last 12 to 15 years, again, I think our state hospital crisis would be much worse than it is. And I think it's very important for the committee and the public to understand how these other projects relate. So I'd just like to make just a few general comments before Dr. Fickle joins us at the table here. And just to say that I think what's happened over the last 15 to 20 years is we've done a very difficult job of managing within a limited number of state hospital beds. I think that we are at a point that could become a crisis in the next year or two. We are struggling mightily with being 55 patients over our budgeted capacity, for example, in the state hospital at this point. Barry mentioned the Deutsch book called Shame of the States, which really described what happened in the two or three decades prior to the 1940s. And I really am hopeful that we not feel that kind of shame in how we've dealt with our state hospital system. I think that the legislative interest at this point in this session is exemplary. We've never had this kind of serious look at the state hospital in our working period with the state. And I really do appreciate the opportunity to do that. Oregon looks a little bit different than other states in terms of the state hospital population. We're about 67% forensic patients in our state hospital. Many states are 20, 30, and 40%. Even states that have a psychiatric security review board are not near to the level that we are. And I think there are many reasons for this. There are no simple, uncomplicated answers. But I do think it's important for the committee to realize how our state hospital system looks much more forensic than most other state hospital systems. I can tell you that most other states are struggling with an increase in forensic population, and that we are not unique at all, but the percentage of forensic patients in our hospital is very great.
Does that mean that in other states people are sort of languishing in prisons that should be getting mental health treatment?
Mr. Chair, I think that's also true in all states, as it is in our state. There are many prisoners in our state who are receiving, I think, adequate, though not the most complete treatment for their mental illnesses. And as the Department of Corrections has testified in other settings, we believe there may be as many as 20% of people in our prisons who are struggling with some kind of mental illness or mental disorder. Now, those people are not necessarily all the same kind of diagnoses that we have in the state hospital, but probably 6 to 8 to 10% probably are very similar in many ways to the patients who are in the state hospital.
Can I follow up your question? That might also come from the fact that we don't have a very high proportion of non-forensic patients in our hospital. I wonder if you have a per capita state hospital population compared to other states.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, that's another very important factor here, that we have a limited number of civil commitment beds for long-term care patients, and we can get that per capita data. It may be just a couple of years old because the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors collects that information, but we can go back and get a comparison.
Be interesting.
I want to conclude my remarks by making a comment about the commitment of the staff at the state hospital and in the community programs, from management to represented employees to the people who make sure that this fairly small community, which cooks meals and mows lawns and cleans buildings, this is an incredibly committed group of people at the state hospital level. And I also want to say the same thing for the people in the community who work hard to help us manage the state hospital population at the level that it is. I really believe that if it weren't for the commitment of individual people all over the state, that this system would frankly be near collapse. And I think it is a credit to the people who are working hard every day, who will not necessarily show up down here for you to see, who are keeping this thing going. So in conclusion, and I think the final thing that I want to mention is the federal environment and the advocacy environment is very different now than it was probably 15 or 20 years ago. The Olmstead Supreme Court decision in 1999 clearly established that states cannot keep people locked up and maintained when they are ready to leave and move into the community. And we've had one lawsuit that we settled, the Miranda B. settlement, and we're working very well on that one and have exceeded all of the requirements of that. That's in the civil commitment area, not in the forensic area. But I think the committee does need to be aware that there is a changing federal environment under the Americans with Disability Act and the Olmstead Supreme Court decision. Finally, families and depending on how they want to be called, patient advocates, consumers, survivors, ex-patients, these are people who are directly impacted by the services, and they are not passive anymore. I think that's a very good sign. That's at times uncomfortable for those of us in Barry and my kind of situations. I have one particular advocate who tells me that she knows I get tired of hearing her, and she's told me that she will be quiet when we fix the system. And I think that's an illustration of the advocacy environment. I think that's a good thing, even though it makes us uncomfortable. But again, I think that the committee should be aware that it's not just those of us who operate the system as good a job as we try to do who are factors in our thinking. It's very important that we pay attention to the families and the needs of individual people.
Bob, maybe you could just take a moment to let the committee know about the contact that you get from the advocates and the patients themselves, because I know that you and I had spoken previously about how you try to be very responsive to folks getting in touch with you, your office. It's pretty, you're pretty available to folks, and maybe you could give my colleagues a perspective of what that's like and how people do have an opportunity to share frustrations.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, my phone number is a direct line is pretty well known. My email is pretty well distributed out there. When I was asked to be the administrator about 2 years ago, one of the things that I felt that needed to happen was a more organized way of meeting with consumers, survivors, advocates. So I formed what is hopefully going to be a more formalized council at some point, but it's composed of anywhere between 10 and 20 consumer advocates who meet with me about once every 2 months. They meet in the intervening month to kind of plot against me and get the agenda lined up. And we have very lively discussions. We've talked about things like treatment courts. We've talked about who determines whether an abuse investigation results in a substantiated or unsubstantiated finding at the state hospital. We've talked about many, many topics. These are sometimes uncomfortable meetings for me, but I find them extremely valuable. So you're right. I do try to maintain as open door as I can, given my schedule. And I also am fortunate to have many friends, colleagues, and neighbors who are people with mental illnesses or who work in the hospitals. And frankly, I talk to them on the streets, wherever they can find me. It's a challenging environment, but I think these are the kinds of things that we need to do in order to understand how the system is really affecting people.
Mr. Chair.
President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, in conjunction with what one request has already been, a fact sheet, the side-by-side statistical information analysis comparing Oregon with other states in this regard, but also something relating to the data as it relates to Oregon's mental health community in relationship to the open door policy with forensic issues, in other words, state hospital issues and the criminally insane, those other folks who are institutionalized. Do you have perhaps, I'm sure that it'll be shared sometime during the week, but some information about how the Oregon plan works in relationship to what other states do.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, yes, we have some of that information, and I think some of it, you're right, will be forthcoming as we do the presentations, but we will make sure that we get you some comparative data on that point as well.
Thank you.
Are you done? Well, I actually had a couple of questions that I didn't want to let go. My first question is you started this, well, you described a situation where we had some real growth occurring in the criminal commitment sector. So my question is, what's driving the growth in the criminal side? And then, sort of as a larger question, what is the census? How does the census itself break down? You answered that, 67% forensics. And then the third one was what the census was at Eastern Oregon University, Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Facility.
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question about what's driving the forensic census population. I think it's a combination of several things. We've talked, Dr. Fickle and I have spent time talking with the courts, with the district attorneys, and our conclusion from talking with them in several different sessions over the last couple of months is that right now all boats rise when there are more mentally ill people arrested. And it's important to realize that most people with mental illnesses who commit crimes end up going through the criminal justice system, not the PSRB system. But there, as the number of people with major mental illnesses get caught in the net of the criminal justice system, a certain percentage of them choose to go through the guilty except for insanity process, and if the court agrees, then they come to us. We've gone from about 90 PSRB adjudications per year to 126 this past year. And the 90 figures were elevated over the previous 2 years. So we know that that's certainly a dynamic that's going on, but we see that generally throughout the system. My own view is that we're looking at issues related to cuts in programs that we had to make a couple of years ago that did not help our cause when we lost the standard mental health and chemical dependency benefit for a period of time. We've reduced the number of people who have that benefit now, even though the standard package is back. As we ratchet from 100,000 down to 24,000, that's making it more difficult for people to get treatment earlier and maintain. We cut every crisis dollar at one point a couple of years ago in the last 2 years when the budget crisis was that severe for people who were non-Medicaid eligible. I think the impact on the working poor, the people who did not have Oregon Health Plan Plus benefits has been significant. The methamphetamine epidemic has been raging in this state. This is not a new thing. We've been dealing with this for 10 years. A number of years ago, we did a survey and found that 1 out of 20 of the acute psychiatric admissions were methamphetamine psychoses. That's an astoundingly large number, and the casualties from that are great. You will probably hear more about that when state hospital staff talk with you more directly about forensic issues. And finally, the issue of safe, affordable housing is an incredibly powerful dynamic in this state. This is not an easy state to live in safe, affordable, alcohol and drug-free housing. And while we've done as much as any state has in creating something like $75 million worth of safe, affordable housing for people with major mental illnesses over the last 12 years, it's still not enough. Our estimates, and I may have mentioned this earlier, we're about 14,000 units short of safe, affordable housing. And these are incredibly stressful factors for people who are not only usually impoverished, but also struggling with the availability of alcohol and drugs and major mental illnesses that make them very vulnerable. So I think there are multiple causes.
I'm sorry, Bob, the number of affordable housing units that we're lacking?
Mr. Chair, it's 14,000. I can get the exact number from you.
That's fine. Thank you. And then the census at the Eastern Oregon facility?
The census, Mr. Chair, at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center is capped at 60. It is almost always at 60. The only time it goes down to 58 or 59 is when we're transferring another patient from this side of the mountains or we are preparing for an acute care admission there.
And those 60 beds are split, are they, between civil and civil and forensic commitments?
Mr. Chair, the beds at Eastern Oregon Psychiatric Center are virtually all civil commitment beds. There have been occasions where we have very carefully selected a forensic patient who usually was from the area for whom the best treatment plan could be created by moving the person there, and the family was agreeable. And so I think we have one PSRB patient there right now.
Where's the facility located physically?
Mr. Chair, that facility is located in Pendleton, and it would be, help me with my geography here a little bit, on the west side of the town.
Okay, all right. Questions from the panel? Okay. All right, thank you very much.
correspondent, Mr.
Yes,
Chair? Representative Westland just sent out a letter to all of us commenting on the 14,000 beds and a call for us to do something about that during this session.
You have a suggestion?
I'm sure you would have some. You must have all received them last week.
We are working with the Housing Community Services folks, and they are providing additional beds, and Bob has met with them as well. While it's baby steps, there are opportunities for us to do better.
Thank you, Representative Butler. And Dr. Fickle, good morning and welcome.
Chairman Dalto, members of the committee, thank you very much for having me visit with you this morning. For the record, my name is Marvin Fickle. I'm the superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. As you've already heard, the issues that we're going to be talking about for the rest of the week are very complicated ones. I know that some of you have had a lot of experience in these areas, and I'm sorry if I'm going to be somewhat redundant at times or too simple. For others of you, hopefully we can get everyone up to speed so that these very, very complex issues can make some sense. It's very difficult even for people who've been around these systems as long as I have, which is quite a long period of time, to make sense out of some of these issues. So bear with me, if you will. We're going to hopefully have a broad range of information presented so that it question that Chairman Dalto just asked can make some sense to people. As you heard from Mr. Cast, many of the issues we're dealing with today are the same ones that we were dealing with at the time of Shampooey, and in many ways the same kind of causes: substance abuse, medical illnesses, lack of housing. These are the same issues that we ultimately are going to be dealing with in trying to figure out what to do about the state hospital. You've also heard about how the role of the state hospital has changed substantially over the last 20 years as a result of changes which really started much earlier following World War II, but culminated in this state in the late 1980s, to the point where we closed one of the state hospitals, damaged state hospital in 1995, and moved much of the acute care provision to the communities. The historical shift of care from the community to the state hospital is one that I would suggest that most all practitioners in this day and age believe is a good one. It's not, it is one that has been internationally received, and in most countries this downsizing of large institutions is something that has been well received. However, most people still believe that there will be a role for some kinds of secure facilities. One of the things that you're going to be hearing about this week is that shift to a forensification, if you will, of the state hospital, but one which also has consequences in terms of how you provide care. Public safety becomes more of an issue that will be discussed in the next presentation, but bear in mind that those kind of issues have been dealt with in various forms from the very beginning. The role of mental illness that is played in criminal behavior is one which continues to be heavily debated at the present time. But again, this is not anything new. This is something that's been going on at least since Civil War times in this state. This raises the question about whether, in fact, there's really a need, at least conceptually, for two different state hospitals. One that is really addressing the issues of the PSRB, the Psychiatric Security Review Board patient, as well as for patients who are civilly committed. We'll probably hear from some of the community advocates regarding the provision of acute care as well as longer-term civil committed care in local communities, and certainly there's a lot of support for that, and it makes a lot of sense. Probably most communities are not going to want to deal with people who have been found guilty except for insanity, except in a centralized institution, and that's one of the things that I'm going to be talking about in just a few minutes. Oregon State Hospital is a joint commission accredited hospital. What that means is the Joint Commission on Accreditation for Hospital Health Organizations on a triennial basis comes, reviews what we do in the hospital, and gives us accreditation or not. We continue to be visited by them on a six-month rotation because of persistent problems of overcrowding. By virtue of our Joint Commission accreditation, we are able to receive federal monies through CMS, as Bob was speaking about earlier. We have two major programs at the hospital. One we call the Psychiatric Recovery Programs, and the other the Forensic Psychiatric Programs. We also have one minor program, which is currently operated administratively separate, called the Forensic Evaluation Service, and I'll get into some detail in a minute what we do there. For the Psychiatric Recovery Programs, patients come from community acute care facilities. In many larger communities throughout Oregon, there is an acute care unit that's attached to a general hospital. People are brought there by the police or by the families, and sometimes voluntarily, to receive relatively short-term treatment, somewhere in the space of 7 to 14 days. For those patients who require longer-term care, often associated with chronic debilitating illness, they would be referred to care either in a state hospital or equivalent services in other parts of the community. The waiting list for patients to get into the hospital is often fairly extensive and may require weeks, if not longer, to finally be transferred to the state hospital, greatly prolonging both the time spent in acute care facilities, but also the expense associated with that. Once someone is on the waiting list for the state hospital...
Representative Greenlake?
I also want to comment that there's a huge waiting list, in fact, for getting into the acute beds, because I did a ride along in an emergency room and found people there for as long as a week in an emergency room, holding room, waiting to get into acute hospital. So that system is pretty stressed as well, I think.
Chairman Dalto, Representative Greenlake, one of the things that you're pointing out by that is the fact that in some ways the whole system is backed up because of the overcrowding problem at the hospital, which then leads not only to inefficiencies. If you're an emergency room physician who has half of his beds taken up by people waiting to get into the hospital rather than dealing with a cardiac emergency, you feel very stressed. People who are brought to the acute care unit under a civil commitment are found to be dangerous to self or others, are unable to provide for basic personal needs, and is not receiving such care as is necessary for health and safety. That's the statutory language. How that translates in various counties depends on the judiciary in those counties, so that you will see the type of persons who come from different areas of the state sometimes differ. An important issue when we're looking also at resources in various parts of the country, or various counties. Different parts of the state have different kinds of needs, and that's an important understanding as we look at the overall impact on the system by changes we might want to make to the state hospital.
Excuse me.
Yes, Representative Tommy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, how the different counties have different needs?
Chairman Dalto, Representative Tomei, part of the issue has to do with the facilities in various counties, the availability of professional help in those counties, the organization of the community mental health care, such that in some counties they have very extensive community care, which you'll hear about later on in the week. Other counties, let's just say that... there are limits both in terms of ongoing care as well as structured living facilities that people might return to the community or to stay in the community.
Okay.
And it really is a function of a variety of things. Bob, you probably want to comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, I think another factor that we haven't talked about a lot is this issue of the equity of funding, particularly for state general fund, because some counties historically reached a very low point in their contract with the state, and there were historical reasons for this. We've made a major step forward on that in the last biennium, where we've begun to move counties that were very low. But, for example, one county ran out of state general fund for for people who were non-Medicaid eligible. That is a very difficult kind of environment in which to divert people. And so they're going to have a different looking civil commitment process, even though the statute is changed. The availability of community resources is absolutely critical. As I say, I think we've taken a major step in the right direction here, but there still are some inequities in funding across the state, which I hope someday we can alleviate.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We've not made any really major changes in our statutes regarding civil commitment for many years. Unlike many other states at this point, we still have a 180-day commitment, or to a maximum of 180-day commitment, and it's usually under that statute that civilly committed people come into the hospital. They can stay for shorter periods of time, but many, in fact, have repeated recommitments while they're at the hospital, either awaiting placement or receiving treatment, or both. Currently, we have two basic types of people in the hospital under a civil commitment. One are adults with chronic psychiatric illnesses, often with schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, depression, post-traumatic illnesses, and substance abuse-related problems. And the other are so-called geropsychiatric patients, so-called because although there are many older patients with dementia or substantial medical problems associated with chronic mental illness, there's also a large and growing number of young head-injured or severely substance abuse patients who are even in their 20s in that program. In our forensic programs, we have two major types of patients as well, two major groups of patients. One are groups of are people who are sent to the hospital under ORS 162370. That's the so-called fitness to the treat for fitness to proceed or aid and assist statutes. Many people, you'll hear them using those words interchangeably, the 370 patient. What that means is that this is somebody who, when after their arrest and during at some point in their incarceration, in their jail time, probably demonstrated some behaviors which indicated to their defense attorney and or the DA and judge that there's a mental illness that keeps them from really working effectively with their attorney. So the judge may send the person to the state hospital for up to a maximum of 3 years or the term of the maximum sentence for that crime for treatment to regain fitness to proceed. It's important that we also distinguish that from what is called criminal responsibility. And although many of the people who are sent to the hospital under a 370 also have a criminal responsibility evaluation, those are two very distinct issues which you'll see later have some importance in terms of how big a facility that you might think is necessary, where these services might be provided in lieu of a hospital setting. And again, unfortunately, raises the level of complexity. The second and larger group of patients who are in our forensic programs are under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. You've heard a little bit about the history of that. These are people who are found guilty except for insanity or under Oregon statutes if, as a result of a mental disease or defect at the time of engaging in criminal conduct, a person lacks substantial capacity either to appreciate the criminality of the conduct or to conform the conduct to the requirements of law. As opposed to some other states like Texas, as you can see, this is called a two-pronged test of criminal responsibility, and that's important in determining how many people actually end up being able to be found guilty except for insanity, and has a much broader definition than many states which have very narrow ones and which hardly ever have patients found guilty except for insanity or not guilty by reason of insanity is a term that some other states use, you've probably heard before. Now we have two campuses, one in our larger one in Salem with currently 671 patients in 19 separate units plus a small number of adolescents who haven't quite left the hospital, and one at the Legacy Holiday Park Hospital site in Northeast Portland, which houses 68 civilly committed adult patients in 3 units. An important aspect of looking at the hospital, and for those of you who visited or seen pictures, you understand that in many ways, this hospital reflects the architecture of a previous generation, or actually several previous generations. Our units in Salem are budgeted to house between 28 and 39 patients, but they weren't physically designed at that level. And with the current patient numbers, somewhere around 58 over budget capacity, many of these units are even much more crowded, at times housing up to 45 patients on a unit. Without going into some of the standards that the federal judiciary has raised, although I'll be certainly glad to answer questions later about that, these are numbers substantially larger than most people would believe provide an adequate treatment environment for people with chronic mental illness. And frankly, when we reach this capacity that we are at now, patients are housed sometimes six or seven in a room that was built for three, sometimes three in a room that were built for one. Group space, offices, meeting spaces have been transformed into bedrooms. As you can see, it's just the very basic crowding because of the number of patients that we have prevent us from doing many of the things that would be appropriate for a state hospital to be doing. We have, over the past several months, at times very closely approached what we consider as our maximum physical space for housing patients. And it has precipitated discussions regarding potential action should we reach that limit. Given that we have several judicial decisions that demand that we accept patients whether we have room or not, as I was hearing about one of the prior superintendents being pulled off a boat in Puget Sound, I was reminded that, you know, we've discussed that, and I'm not really fond of being arrested for any cause. But there are certain situations that we have attempted to address that fortunately have not yet come to fruition there. One of the major things that we have attempted to do over the last several years in terms of the hospital itself is to begin to humanize the hospital environment, working towards making it a much more patient-centered facility, and as you'll hear from Dr. Chandragiri, implementing what people now call recovery-oriented approach to treatment. In a line or two, basically we're talking about making the return of the patient to the community one that is planned from day one, that the ability of that patient is not limited by expectations of the staff, but rather what in fact they can achieve. It's very difficult, however, and under our current circumstances, being as overcrowded and frankly understaffed as we are, to accomplish that in the physical environment that we're looking at. We're attempting to integrate as much as possible, perhaps not as much as Bob would sometimes like to believe, patient input into the organizational decision making, both patients who are currently at the hospital as well as those who've had some prior experience with the hospital, family members, community advocates, putting them into the community structure of the hospital so as to inform decisions on an ongoing basis. We've attempted to revitalize the diversity and cultural competence programs at the hospital, reflecting a change in demographics both to the state but also to the patients who come to the hospital, attempting to meet both their cultural and spiritual needs in that fashion. And finally, attempting to organize the delivery of care around evidence-based practices. Probably all of you on this committee have heard about evidence-based practice, so you're tired of it, but it is one of those. It's more than just a catchword for what's modern in medicine. As you've probably already heard the joke, but I'll just say it anyways. You know, everyone hears that medicine is moving towards evidence-based practice, and you know, everybody goes, "Well, what were they doing before?" Part of the issue is that the complexity of so much of what is done in medicine in this day and age requires a sophistication that, frankly, can only come about after thorough examination of literature and studies, oftentimes well beyond the purview of a single practitioner or certainly an organization of the size of the state hospital. We We organize our treatment teams at the hospital around a physician, a psychologist, a social worker, and nursing staff. Almost every unit has at least that basic configuration. We're also attempting to look at that. Does that make the most sense in terms of what we're trying to do at the state hospital? Because many of the units have different functions. So an ongoing thing that you'll probably hear about from some of our speakers is, what is the optimal treatment environment? What is the optimal treatment team? Part of our expectations in a hospital setting is the ability to provide treatment that is really meaningful, not just warehouse people. As you can appreciate, you know, yes, Chairman Dalto?
Representative Mayne.
Thank you. On your treatment team, is the physician a psychiatrist?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
As you can expect, due to the type of patients that we have at the hospital, medication obviously plays a major role in treatment. However, medication alone does not assist people in making significant recovery to the point where they're able to return to a meaningful life in the community, because that's really what we're talking about. Most psychiatrists, most mental health professionals in this day and age believe that the limitations that we have in many ways believed was natural, quote-unquote, to mental illness, that kept people in the community from being able to have a job, to be, to have significant and meaningful relationships, is really one that is a very artificial one. And there's no reason why most of the people who've spent time in the state hospital cannot return to productive lives in the community. Because of the kind of problems that we've faced at the hospital for many years, in terms of the overcrowding and the small number of staff that we have relative to our size, we've begun to attempt to implement larger and more active treatment programs in what are so-called treatment malls. That is, maximizing the number of people that can be treated along a certain in a certain area. For instance, our 370 recovery groups. That is, teaching people about what they need to know to be able to function in a courtroom setting are now being done in a group process rather than a one-to-one or a small group process on an individual unit. As you've heard, about two-thirds of our current patients are forensic patients, and about a third of them are civil patients. You've also already heard some discussion about why there has been this shift in this state while there's not been a similar or equivalent situation in other states. What perhaps you haven't heard or are not aware to the extent of which, in many ways, the Department of Corrections and the county jails have functioned in to replace what in the past may have been received in other settings. Now, why, in fact, does that happen? I mean, part of it, I think Bob has actually outlined very well what some of those kind of issues are, but I think it's also important if you can personalize how that process happened. The role that drugs, particularly methamphetamine, have played in this state cannot be overemphasized. It's taken a role that in other places and other times, things like cocaine and PCP have taken in terms of being an almost determinant of getting you involved in criminal activity, to getting arrested, and not being able to function in a normal kind of way. Now, with the changing of that patient mix essentially on its head over the last 20 years, and with the seriousness of the crime in many ways being a determinant of how long you stay in the hospital, the types of patients has also changed, specifically in terms of the seriousness of their psychiatric disorder. Many people would claim, and you'll hear greater detail about this, about the severity of psychiatric disorder in some of our forensic populations, and certainly relative to our civil population, it is generally not as severe. By and large, people have to spend longer times in the hospital because of their public safety issues than they would if it were based purely on their psychiatric disorder. As you'll hear on Wednesday, we have begun with the assistance of the legislature to develop a framework master plan for looking at what makes the most sense for the hospital in the next decade at a minimum. although certainly our planning really should go on well beyond the next decade. The effort, along with the governor's task force report, which you'll also hear about on Wednesday, is intended to provide you with an outline of potential options for future development. Whatever decisions are made in this current legislative session, we at the hospital are going to have to persist under the current circumstances for at least another 5 years. Even if Governor Kulongowski walked in today and with a check in hand and we started building, as you can appreciate, we are in essence stuck in our current situation. And unless we can maintain the discharge of patients at our current level, and perhaps even if we can, we will quickly exhaust both our physical plant as well as our employees. I don't believe that the current level of overcrowding can be sustained indefinitely, and with the incredible increase in patients under PSRB and the much increased rate of growth in our population, much greater than we had previously anticipated, we very well could be in an even more serious circumstance if we're not able to get people into community settings in a very timely fashion. We sincerely hope that the projected development of community resources can relieve the census burden. If not, I have some concerns that our staff will be able to do the job that they signed on to do. Thank you very much for your attention, and I'll be certainly willing to answer any questions.
Thanks very much, Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Bickle, the census growth is probably not unique to Oregon with the meth problem nationwide. What are other states doing? Are they building hospitals at this point? Are they growing out their patient care? What's happening?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, maybe I can tackle that question. I know one of my colleagues in Utah added 30 forensic beds to his hospital just now. They're immediately full. Connecticut, one of my colleagues there I talked to last fall, he had also added forensic beds to his state hospital. They were immediately full and overflowing. I think those are the kinds of things that most states are experiencing.
Mr. Chair, if I may, these are 30 added new beds. I'm assuming these are at existing facilities or modified methods of treatment and other care. These have got to be expensive facilities to build. I've got to believe that Oregon is in much the same fiscal shape that many other states. Are they putting out the tens of millions and hundreds of millions of dollars to add new bricks and mortar?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, there are about 8 to 10 states that, according to our information now, are either in the planning stages or are in the construction stages. And the costs of these facilities look like they're between $20 and $70 million. And that's the easy part in some ways, just building it. Then there's the operating costs.
Chairman Alto, Representative Butler, if I might add, the experience of Western Washington State, north of us in Tacoma, or south of slightly south of Tacoma, is, I think, useful. As you may be aware, they essentially rebuilt their entire state hospital over the period of about 8 years. Newly finished forensic unit about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. However, by the time that new buildings were completed, they were already suffering from many of the same kind of fiscal crises that we are. And in an attempt to deal with the fact that although they built these new facilities, they were immediately full, they began to attempt to return people to the community more rapidly and to utilize a variety of community resources to minimize the number of people who might get into the hospital and also to shorten lengths of stay. For most of the state of Washington, that's worked fairly effectively, although, as you well know from the news, some counties have fared better than others.
Thank you. I guess this is for both of you. It seems like there are several things that sort of exacerbated this problem in Oregon, and one of them, as I recall you saying, was that when we decreased the population in the Oregon Health Plan from 100,000... Thank you, Mary. 100,000 to 24,000. That was certainly an issue. Is that true? And we also cut crisis funding some years ago, a couple years ago.
Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, yes, I mentioned those because I think those are the logical places to look in terms of cutbacks in service that may have exacerbated this situation. I mean, one of the problems that we have is we've not invested in this state in enough front-end services to prevent people from getting so ill that they have to go first to acute care and then later on to extended care and state hospital care. I've mentioned before there is one project in this community that we are in now called the East Project that takes young folks having their first psychotic episode and provides them with the definitive care that they need. They've served, I think, 80 or 90 families at this point, and they are showing, I think, the kind of results that if we're ever going to get ahead of this problem and not try to build our way out of it, those are the kind of programs we're going to have at this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Greenlee.
Just a couple of brief questions. We're going to hear Wednesday about the planning process. Is that planning process intended to produce recommendations in time to be acted on in this legislative session?
Chairman Dalto, Representative Greenlee, what we call the Phase 1 Framework Master Plan is going to be presented in the final form to the legislature on May 16th. We hope that if there is significant findings prior to that time, that some of them can be certainly shared with many other people. Part of the issue is that despite the fact that we have attempted to move along in this process as rapidly as possible, we only received the money or received notification of the money in November, and these processes take quite a long time. In most situations, you would normally be looking at a 12 to 18 month period. We are hoping that with the May 16th report, the legislature will see fit to proceed with the second half, and in many ways the more important part of the master plan, to build on the developments that we've looked at in the first part with the input that we've gotten, and then hopefully to be able to present to the e-board some definitive plan at some point in terms of whether we need to build a new hospital, what we need to do with our old facility, what kind of services need to be provided where. Because many of these issues are all very closely linked
together. Another 12-month time frame, say?
Correct.
And just off the top, there was a number I remember for an estimate of the cost of simply tearing down, as my colleague here has referred to, as the monster on Center Street. Am I right in remembering there's a number that has
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I will have to go back. I know that there was a study about 10, 12 years ago, and Mr. Hammer may have that information handy. We will go back and try to figure it out. It was a large number, though.
And one more question, sir. The closing of the safe pits, and I do remember that movie and its impact on the whole thing. And the closing of Damish, which wasn't the snake pit, I think, by any measure, was predicated on the development of a community mental health system, partly with federal funds, in fact, mostly with federal funds and partly with state funds. Could you comment on the extent to which you think, a very brief comment, because we can get into it again as the deep goes on the extent to which the promised community mental health system to back up the closing of so many state hospital beds, how close did we get to doing what we promised we'd do?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, I'm not sure what we promised. You know, historically, I think we want to go back and look carefully at the record, what we should have promised. We have partially delivered on. I think if you look at the 1988 Governor's Commission inpatient report, we delivered on a good part of that. However, that happened in the context shortly thereafter of ballot measure 5. So much of what we developed that led to the closure of Damish in the subsequent years has all been done in a fiscal crisis environment, and we have not plowed back all of the money that we lost into that process, and I think in that sense we failed to meet the promise.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Chairman Dalto, Representative Greenlee, if I might, I Bob and I differ slightly in terms of our appreciation of this question, and I think it's useful to understand how complex that relationship between community facilities, community mental health services, and state hospital beds really is. Because when you look at various other states who've attempted, frankly, Oregon's not alone. There's 49 other states who've unfortunately made inadequate decisions regarding the relative trade-off there, and are often presented with identical kind of situation. So we hopefully can learn from some of their experience. New York has recently, well, 3 years ago now, determined or decided that for every dollar that they're closing in community resources, that equivalent dollar is put into investment in the community, and that's not something that many states have actually done.
I mean, I don't think either Bob or I underestimate the complexity of the relationship between state beds and the community mental health system, but there, I mean, it was very clear when we were going to close state hospitals that the federal government was going to help us create a mental health system in the community to care for those people and to care for the future growth of those people. We did have Measure 5, but we also had changes in my perception of what almost became an unfunded mandate to the state, because the block grant, for example, and the support for community mental health systems has declined, I think, both in relative and absolute terms since, say, 1985. And that's been a huge problem for us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlee, if I might just add that the federal mental health block grant is about $4 or $5 million a year out of $350 to $400 million a year operation. So it's the federal block grant is important because it goes for people who are not Medicaid eligible, and if we didn't have it, we would be in even bigger trouble. The big federal participation, of course, is Medicaid, and in that sense, we have done what we've been able to do as successfully as we have, relatively speaking, because of the federal participation in Medicaid. As you are probably aware, there are questions about the future of Medicaid, and I think those are of great interest to all of us in this state, given that what we've done in closing a major state hospital and trying to maintain a reasonably sized hospital really is very dependent on Medicaid funding.
Medicaid and Medicare, because the chronically mentally ill are also disabled.
Okay.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thank you. Representative Boone, we're going to have to wrap this panel up, but go ahead.
Okay, I just want to make a short comment and thank Bob for mentioning the fact that we have not put the money up front. And I started working in child abuse issues in 1978, and those were the people in the trenches telling us then that we need to pay attention to this, because these people or these little kids are going to grow up, and they're going to have problems if we don't address them. And I don't think we've been adequate in addressing these problems. And those kids have now grown up, and it's 20 and 30 years later, 30 years later, I guess, and we really need to listen to what you've said, and right now we're trying to play catch-up, and it's expensive.
Okay. Thanks very much. Thank you both very much. And we're going to move on to our last panel. It's going to be John Keogh and George Bacik. I'm sure that I butchered those names, but you can correct me. And I'd like to go about 20 minutes or less on this, so we have about 10 minutes apiece so that we can wrap up our meeting. So, good morning, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is John Keogh. I'm the director of Oregon State Hospital's Forensic Psychiatric Service. I'd like to speak briefly to add a bit more detail to the information that's been provided to you just prior to this. At the hospital, as you've heard, in our forensic services, we are running at 50 to 60 patients above our budgeted capacity, and we're very close to hitting our physical capacity. And so there are a number of things that we have to do to try to maintain the services and the programs and not get overwhelmed. So I'd like to talk a little bit about those in terms of the two primary groups of people that we work with. You've heard some about this already this morning. We work with people basically pre-trial. These are people who have been in a court. They've been in front of a judge. They've been assigned an attorney. They've been charged with some criminal activity. And in that court process, the judge decides that they are not fit to proceed with trial because they can't understand the proceedings that are they're involved in. At that point, the judge sends these people to us, and the mission for us under these circumstances is pretty clear-cut. We need to get these people to be able to participate meaningfully in a trial. In the average month, we get about 23 people in, and we get about 22 people out. It takes us anywhere between 6 days and 3 years to get a person ready for trial. The greatest number of people go out in about 85 days. So of our inpatient population of about 93, we turn those beds over, or we use those beds to serve people about three times each year. We have two-thirds of our population is male in this category. About a third of them are women, and it seems as though we're serving more women pre-trial than we have in prior years. The kind of things that we do to help people get ready for trial are to assess them for their need for psychotropic medications. We provide medicine. And we provide other kinds of talk therapies like anger management, like symptom management. And in addition to that, we especially work with them so that they can understand a court proceeding. We talk with them about what the role of the judge is, what the role of the attorneys are, how to behave in a courtroom. And in particular, we work with them so that they can understand their plea options and the consequences of a plea. So as we understand, in facing charges, one might plead guilty, one might plead innocent, one might plead guilty except for insanity, and each of these choices has very real consequences. A person presented with these choices and facing criminal charges who has a mental illness might decide, with the help of counsel, to plead guilty except for insanity. And the consequence of that, should the court decide that that was the correct plea, would be to come to Oregon State Hospital. The same person with a mental illness and facing charges might decide that they didn't want to be stigmatized by a mental illness, didn't want to be in a state hospital. They might plead guilty and go into the state's prison system still having a mental illness. And I think it's important to remember that because it illustrates the similarities between a great deal of the population in the state hospital and the population in the prison. In any case, we work with people to restore their fitness to proceed and to get them back into court. That brings us to the second major group of people that we work with. These are citizens that have had their day in court. They have made their plea of guilty except for insanity, and the court has found that to be the case, and then they come to us with great variety in the charges that they have been found guilty except for insanity of, and a great variety in the length of time that they will be under the supervision of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. So predicting or giving you a sense of how long people are in the forensic services is difficult because the range is so broad. We have some people out within a couple of months. We have other people that are there for more than 20 years. It would perhaps help to talk about a period of time of about 4 years, which is when many people experience a conditional release back into the community in a supervised setting. In working with people to get them into supervised settings, it's important for us to have a handle on not only their mental health needs, but also the risks that they present to the community. We have a number of tools that we work with that help us to assess a person's risk once they're back into the community. We look at their history, we look at the criminal record that they have, and we look at the interplay of mental illness and crime. We consider how they have responded to treatment, how they have learned in the course of hospitalization, and then we attempt to match the setting in the community with the presentation that we find at the end of their course of hospitalization. The crowding impacts us in another important way. It puts an edge to the life of people in the hospital. When you have seven people in a room that is designed to accommodate four, they bump into each other more often. And we work with a population of people who, obviously having a mental illness, have low frustration tolerance sometimes. Sometimes they're quick to anger. And a great challenge to us is to maintain a safe environment in which people can focus then on the kind of treatment that they need to make progress with in order to get on with their lives. So thinking back to Barry Cass' discussion with you and the notion of asylum, it continues to be a very important aspect of what we try to achieve at the hospital today. We're trying to maintain a safe place so that people can focus on treatment. And finally, a major focus of our treatment is to help each individual develop a relapse prevention plan. Prior to going into the community, it's important for them to have a plan that will help them identify risky situations, risky behaviors, and to see those things coming before they get caught up in them. So we send each person out with a relapse prevention plan that they can put into play when times get tough and they're tempted to drink alcohol or to use drugs or to get involved with other people or activities that wouldn't be healthy for them. We're pretty busy, and those are some of the efforts that that we make to get people ready for discharge. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Chairman Dalto and members of the committee, thank you for allowing us to speak. My name is George Bocek. I'm director of social work at Oregon State Hospital. And I've got 41 years of experience in various state hospitals over three states. And I still love my job. One of the things I'd like to do is give you an example of a current case we have in a minute. But before I get there, I'd like to mention that this year we have, so far to date, as of Friday, have discharged on conditional release 186 psychiatric security review patients. 36 of those went into new beds developed this biennium, and six more went into new beds and went into backfill of new beds that people took from the community. We are hoping by the end of this biennium to have placed over 100 PSRB patients in new beds. So we are actively working with the Office of Mental Health, the counties, and the PSRB to develop new beds and get patients in them. We always have 150 people, almost always, in discharge planning process. And the reason we always have 150 people in the discharge planning process is because it takes at least about 6 months to discharge a person onto conditional release. There are a number of reviews at the hospital level. There's the PSRB request for evaluations that are county evaluations.
And then there's provider evaluations, such as housing and mental health services. And there's applications for benefits for medical cards and Social Security. And in addition to all these mountains of paperwork and bits of information, we still have to come up and work closely with the counties for the match in the type of person for the facility. So I'd like to talk about a patient we have now. I'll call him John Doe since SpongeBob is taken. But this man is doing very well, and his treatment team said he's ready to go. So we started through this process of reviews and so forth, finally got to the point where the evaluation was ordered to the county. So the county came and saw him and said, we like him. We would like to take him. He's ready to go. So we went to the next level of the housing provider, and the housing provider said, well, we just found out he has HIV positive, and we are worried that if he got an infection, we couldn't handle those medical issues, and therefore we're not going to take him. So then we went to Plan B, which was another county. And the county came and saw this man and said, oh, we like him. He's ready to go. He's doing well, and so forth. And so we went to the provider and for the housing and so forth. And the provider said, well, we like him, but he has diabetes, and we don't think we can manage diabetes. And we said, but he manages it himself. He does his own blood tests, and he gives his own shots, and he watches his diet. We taught him all these things. He said, we still can't handle those medical problems. So we went to Plan C, which was our patient's own idea. He called his former group home and said, can I come back? And this was in another county. And they said, we would love to have you. And the Psychiatric Security Review Board said, no, you can't go back there. The reason you had to come back in the first place is there wasn't enough security there. So we went to Plan D, which was another county. And we presented the case, and everything was going along fine. They could even handle the medical issues I described, and of course they thought he was doing well, because he is. And then we ran into a different barrier. He makes too much money on his VA income, and therefore he doesn't get the medical card, and therefore there is no way to pay for the case management and the medicines. So this gentleman has been in discharge planning for probably a year. He's still in the hospital. We still haven't solved these problems. But it does give you an idea why it's so hard to answer the question, well, if there were beds out there today, how many could leave today? Because that's the most common question we get asked by legislators and media and administration. Well, I always answer about 25, because there are so many people close that with all the money in place and everything, we could always do that, and that's a continuous flow. But in reality, it's not an easy answer because of these kind of things. This man is ready to go, and it makes it very difficult. So thank you for your time. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me in this last case that there needs to be someone who can make a common sense decision and just do it.
Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson, yes. The problem is the providers develop what they're good at, and we're working really close with the Office of Mental Health to develop more specializations. The kind of things that are be developing now, for example, are homes that do specialize in medical issues, homes that specialize in traumatic brain injury. There are some homes that specialize in lower functioning patients. And a lot of these things are on the books. And one of the problems that we do have that's sort of outside our system and perhaps our common sense solution is the changes to the medical card, where we have eliminated the ability to do a spend down. This particular man makes $1,700 a month in VA, which could go toward his cost of care, but he still can't get the medical card. So we're trying to go through a process of a medical trust, which will hopefully allow us to get a medical card, because he still has medications, case management, and therapy that he has to go to. We have a number of patients that do not have an Axis 1 diagnosis, which is our major mental illness diagnosis, other than substance abuse of some sort. And again, these people are not eligible for medical cards. And so in those cases, the Office of Mental Health has to pay full general funds to get them out. But some counties will not refer, will not accept patients without a medical card. So there are a lot of these kind of things that play into difficulty in moving patients. It's not just the beds in the community.
Okay. A fascinating presentation this morning, and we're going to continue it on Wednesday. I think this is great. I think we learned a lot, and we have a solid foundation for the future work going. I thank you both very much, and I thank all of our panelists today for giving us this overview on the state hospital. And with no other business before the committee, we will adjourn this meeting.